The following is an excerpt from the Berkshire Hathaway 2013 annual report. I reread this recently and found it particularly fascinating, and I knew immediately that I wanted to share it with you. You can find the full letter at our website, stevepomerantz.com, and so let's get started. Here it goes. It starts out with a quote from Ben Graham, Buffett's professor at Columbia University and mentor. Some thoughts about investing. Investment is most intelligent when it is most businesslike. And this is a quote from The Intelligent Investor, the book by Ben Graham. Buffett goes on to write, "It is fitting to have a Ben Graham quote open this discussion because I owe so much of what I know about investing to him. I'll talk more about Ben a little later, and I will even sooner talk about common stocks. But first, let me tell you about two small non-stock investments that I made long ago. Though neither changed my net worth by much, they are instructive. This tale begins in Nebraska. From 1973 to 1981, the Midwest experienced an explosion in farm prices, caused by the widespread belief that runaway inflation was coming and fueled by the lending policies of small rural banks. Then the bubble burst, bringing price declines of 50% or more that devastated both leveraged farmers and their lenders. Five times as many Iowa and Nebraska banks failed in that bubble's aftermath than in our recent Great Recession. In 1986, I purchased a 400-acre farm located 50 miles north of Omaha from the FDIC. It cost me $280,000, considerably less than what a failed bank had lent against the farm a few years earlier. I knew nothing about operating a farm. I have a son who loves farming, and I learned from him both how many bushels of corn and soybeans the farm would produce and what the operating expenses would be. From these estimates, I calculated the normalized return from the farm to then be about 10%. I also thought it was likely that productivity would improve over time and that crop prices would move higher as well. Both expectations proved out. I needed no unusual knowledge or intelligence to conclude that the investment had no downside and potentially had substantial upside. There would, of course, be the occasional bad crop and prices that would sometimes disappoint. But so what? There would also be some unusually good years as well, and I would never be under any pressure to sell the company. Now, 28 years later, the farm has tripled its earnings and is worth five times more what I paid. I still know nothing about farming and recently made just my second visit to the farm. In 1993, I made another small investment. Larry Silverstein, Solomon's landlord when I was the company's CEO, told me about a New York retail property adjacent to NYU that the Resolution Trust Corp. was selling. Again, a bubble had popped, this one involving commercial real estate, and the RTC had been created to dispose of the assets of the failed savings institutions whose optimistic lending practices had fueled the folly. Here, too, the analysis was simple. As had been the case with the farm, the unleveraged current yield of the property was about 10%. But the property had been undermanaged by the RTC, and its income would increase when several vacant stores were leased. Even more important, the largest tenant, who occupied around 20% of the project's space, was paying rent of about $5 per foot, whereas other tenants averaged $70. The expiration of this bargain lease in 9 years was certain to provide a major boost to earnings. The property's location was also superb. NYU wasn't going anywhere. So I joined a small group, including Larry and my friend Fred Rose, that purchased the parcel. Fred was an experienced high-grade real estate investor who, with his family, would manage the property. And manage it, they did. The old leases expired, earnings tripled, annual distributions now exceed 35% of our original equity investment. Moreover, our original mortgage was refinanced in 1996 and again in 1999, moves that allowed several special distributions totaling more than 150% of what we had invested. I've yet to view the property. Income from both the farm and the NYU real estate will probably increase in the decades to come. Though the gains won't be dramatic, the two investments will be solid and satisfactory holdings for my lifetime and subsequently for my children and grandchildren. I tell these tales to illustrate certain fundamentals of investing. Number one, you don't need to be an expert in order to achieve satisfactory investment returns. But if you aren't, you must recognize your limitations and follow a course certain to work reasonably well. Keep things simple and don't swing for the fences. When promised quick profits, respond with a quick no. Number two, focus on the future productivity of the asset you're considering. If you don't feel comfortable making a rough estimate on the asset's future earnings, just forget it and move on. No one has the ability to evaluate every investment possibility, but omniscience isn't necessary. You only need to understand the actions you undertake. Number three, if you instead focus on the prospective price change of a contemplated purchase, you're speculating. There's nothing improper about that. I know, however, that I am unable to speculate successfully, and I'm skeptical of those who claim sustained success at doing so. Half of all coin flippers will win their first toss. None of those winners has an expectation of profit if he continues to play the game. And the fact that a given asset has appreciated in the recent past is never reason to buy it. Number four, with my two small investments, I thought only of what the properties would produce and cared not at all about their daily valuations. Games are won by players who focus on the playing field, not by those whose eyes are glued to the scoreboard. If you can enjoy Saturdays and Sundays without looking at stock prices, give it a try on weekdays. Number five, forming macro opinions or listening to the macro or market predictions of others is a waste of time. Indeed, it is dangerous because it may blur your vision of the facts that are truly important. When I hear TV commentators glibly opine on what the market will do next, I'm reminded of Mickey Mantle's scathing comment, "You don't know how easy this game is until you get into that broadcasting booth." For those of you that are joining us midstream, I'm taking an excerpt from the Berkshire Hathaway 2013 annual report, which I recently reread and sharing it with you today. Point number six, my two purchases were made in 1986 and 1993. What the economy, interest rates, or the stock market might do in the years immediately following, 1987 and 1994, was of no importance to me in making those investments. I can't remember what the headlines or pundits were saying at the time. Whatever the chatter, corn would keep growing in Nebraska and students would flock to NYU. There is one major difference between my two small investments and an investment in stocks. Stocks provide you minute-to-minute valuations for your holdings, whereas I have yet to see a quotation for either my farm or the New York real estate. It should be an enormous advantage for investors in stocks to have those wildly fluctuating valuations placed on their holdings, and for some investors it is. After all, if a moody fellow with a farm bordering my property yelled out a price every day to me at which he would either buy my firm or sell his, and those prices varied widely over short periods of time depending on his mental state, how in the world could I be other than benefited by his erratic behavior? If his daily shout-out was ridiculously low and I had some spare cash, I'd buy his farm. If the number he yelled was absurdly high, I could either sell to him or just go on farming. Owners of stocks, however, too often let the capricious and often irrational behavior of their fellow owners cause them to behave irrationally as well. Because there is so much chatter about markets, the economy, interest rates, price behavior of stocks, and so on, some investors believe it is important to listen to pundits, and worse yet, important to consider acting upon their comments. Those people who can sit quietly for decades when they own a farm or apartment house too often become frenetic when they're exposed to a stream of stock quotations and accompanying commentators delivering an implied message of, just don't sit there, do something. For those investors, liquidity is transformed from the unqualified benefit it should be to a curse. A flash crash or some other extreme market fluctuation can't hurt an investor any more than an erratic and mouthy neighbor can hurt my farm investment. Indeed, tumbling markets can be helpful to the true investor if he has cash available when prices get far out of line with values. A climate of fear is your friend when investing. A euphoric world is your enemy. During the extraordinary financial panic that occurred late in 2008, I never gave a thought to selling my farm or New York real estate, even though a severe recession was clearly brewing. And if I had owned 100% of a solid business with good long-term prospects, it would have been foolish for me to even consider dumping it. So why would I have sold my stocks that were small participations in wonderful businesses? True, any one of them might eventually disappoint, but as a group, they were certain to do well. Could anyone really believe the earth was going to swallow up the incredible productive assets and unlimited human ingenuity existing in America? When Charlie and I buy stocks, and just a note here, he's talking about his partner Charlie Munger, which we think of as small portions of businesses, our analysis is very similar to that which we use to buy entire businesses. We first have to decide whether we can sensibly estimate an earnings range for 5 years out or more. If the answer is yes, we will buy the stock or business if it sells at a reasonable price in relation to the bottom boundary of our estimate. If, however, we lack the ability to estimate future earnings, which is usually the case, we simply move on to other prospects. In the 54 years we have worked together, we have never foregone an attractive purchase because of the macro or political environment or the views of other people. In fact, these subjects never come up when we make decisions. It's vital, however, that we recognize the perimeter of our circle of competence, and that circle of competence is in quotes, and stay well inside of it. Even then, we will make our mistakes, both with stocks and businesses, but they will not be the disasters that occur, for example, when a long rising market induces purchases that are based on anticipated price behavior and a desire to be where the action is. Most investors, of course, have not made the study of business prospects a priority in their lives. If wise, they will conclude that they do not know enough about specific businesses to predict the future earning power. I have good news for these non-professionals. The typical investor doesn't need this skill. In aggregate, American businesses have done wonderfully well over time and will continue to do so. In parentheses, he says, though most assuredly in predictable fits and starts. Close parentheses. In the 20th century, the Dow Jones Industrial Index advanced from 66 to 11,497, paying a rising stream of dividends to boot. The 21st century will witness further gains, almost certain to be substantial. The goal of the non-professional should not be to pick winners. Neither he nor his helpers can do that, but should rather be to own a cross-section of businesses that in aggregate are bound to do well. A low-cost S&P 500 index fund can achieve this goal. That's the what of investing for the non-professional. The when is also important. The main danger is that the timid or beginning investor will enter the market at a time of extreme exuberance and then become disillusioned when paper losses occur. Remember the late Barton Biggs observation, a bull market is like sex. It feels best just before it ends. The antidote to that kind of mistiming is for an investor to accumulate shares over a long period and never to sell them when the news is bad and stocks are well off their highs. If investors frenetically bought and sold farmland to each other, neither the yields nor prices of their crops would be increased. The only consequence of such behavior would be decreases in overall earnings realized by the farm-owning population because of the substantial costs it would incur as it sought advice and switched properties. Nevertheless, both individuals and institutions will constantly be urged to be active by those who profit from giving advice or effecting transactions. The resulting frictional costs can be huge and, for investors in the aggregate, devoid of benefit. So ignore the chatter, keep your costs minimal, and invest in stocks as you would in a farm. These are the words of Warren Buffett from the 2013 Berkshire Hathaway report. And, you know, we thought about talking with you, and you know that this is not a phone-in show, but we really want to hear your questions, and we want to find out what's on your mind. So write to us at stevepomerantz.com. Thanks for listening.